All right, we can get started now. Warren Ortland is a staff attorney with the Public Health Law Center located at the William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. He provides legal technical support to organizations working to increase the number of smoke-free multi-unit housing developments in Twin Cities metro area and the greater Duluth area and in various communities around the state of Minnesota. He is also the current co-principal investigator on a research study reviewing the impact of secondhand smoke in common interest communities such as condominiums, cooperatives, and planned communities. So welcome, Warren.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being on the call.
Okay.
Why don't you first tell us a little bit about your work in assisting nonprofit organizations and local health departments with smoke-free policies in multi-unit communities.
Sure. Yeah. As Pete was saying, I work with some nonprofits. Right now, my two major organizations that I support, I have contracts with a program called Live Smoke Free, which is part of the Association for Nonsmokers of Minnesota. And they get money from the Minnesota Department of Health to provide services as well as materials to help promote more smoke-free housing in the greater metropolitan area, which is...
Hey, Warren, I think you should turn it up just a little bit more.
Okay. Is this better? Okay.
Is everybody, can everybody hear Warren?
Yes.
Okay. So that's the seven-county metro area of Minneapolis-St. Paul. And then I also support the American Lung Association in Minnesota. They have an office in Duluth in northeast Minnesota. And so I provide them support also on smoke-free housing. Then we're just starting with a program called SHIP, which is the State Health Improvement Program. I think it's designed basically on the STEPS program. And the state has made quite a bit of money available to promote all different kinds of health prevention, health improvement. And one aspect of that is to promote more smoke-free housing. So through that program, I'll be providing support to several counties around the state as well as they try to incent more landlords and to go smoke-free. Part of what I do for all the organizations is I attend meetings with landlords. So when they meet with landlord organizations, I will speak about the legal issues that come up around adopting smoke-free policies. The other service I provide is I present at conferences. A couple of the conferences that I present at is the Minnesota branch of the National Association for Housing and Redevelopment Officials, which are officials who work on federally subsidized housing or public housing. And then I also present at the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, which is an association for landlords in Minnesota. The other service I provide is I can handle some tenant phone calls. I can't provide direct legal representation or specific legal advice. Sometimes it's a kind of a fine line between what I can tell them and what I can't. But I can give them information on resources that they can turn to or options that they may want to try, organizations that might be able to help them, such as legal aid or other tenants' rights organizations. And I also help draft legally related fact sheets. If landlords need information on what kind of notice they need to provide to tenants, if they're going to be changing a lease, or just information in regards to what kinds of language that you want to put into a lease, I can help them with that. So they call me the guy with the tie. So whenever there's a legally related question, I can address those. Just again, the fine line is I can't provide direct legal representation or give advice specific to a client. So,
Greg, seems like keep you busy there.
Yeah.
Does anybody have any questions for Warren about his general work? Being none, we'll move on to the second topic. So let's talk a little bit about the low-income housing tax credit program and how it works.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about the program, what its purpose is, and how tax credits can be obtained.
Sure. The low-income housing tax credit program is a federal program, and it's intent is to try to stimulate the development of more affordable housing across the country. And so the Internal Revenue Service allocates tax credits to all the states, and they do this based on population. The last time I checked, I believe it was like $1.75 of tax credits per individual in the state, so it's several million dollars. And they give those to one particular agency within the state. And I looked up, and in Colorado, the agency that receives the tax credits is the Colorado Housing and Finance Authority. In Minnesota, it's a very similar name. We have the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And so those agencies get the tax credits. They can use them themselves to incent development, and they can also, in certain cases, sub-allocate to other local units of government. And so what the TEDx credits are they're a dollar-for-dollar offset against an individual's tax bill. And so these tax credits are used by developers of low-income property to attract investors. So investors can give money, or they buy the tax credits, usually on a discounted basis because they're applied over like 10 years. But they buy those, and then it's a direct offset against their tax bill. What the allocator does, either the state housing finance agency or one of the local units of government, they develop what's called a qualified allocation plan. And this qualified allocation plan is a kind of a checklist of the kinds of property that they want to incent or develop in their community. So we could have features such as if you want to have buildings built in a certain geographic area, you would get more points. If you wanted to serve a certain minority population, you might get more points. In one of them, I think in California, if the developed building included internet access, then they'd get a certain number of points. If it was close to rapid transit, then it got points. So it's a competition among developers of property to try to get their property aligned best to the city or the state's qualified allocation plans in order to get the tax credits. And what we saw, and we thought this was an interesting idea, and Maine and California were the first to move forward with this program as a way to incent smoke-free housing. So in California, they changed their qualified allocation plan to include a point in this checklist or competition if 50% of the new development units were designated as smoke-free. And in Maine went a little farther, and they would give 1 point if 100% of the units in the new development were designated as smoke-free. And also they required to have cessation information available in the new development. Now, by reasons of our contract with the Department of Health, we cannot work on state-level policy, but we can work at city and county level. And in Minnesota, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency gets the full allotment or allocation of tax credits from the government, but then it sub-allocates to other local units of government. So we have two counties, Washington and Dakota County, that get tax credits. And then we have five cities. We have Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, St. Cloud, and Rochester. And the ones that were in our area were Duluth, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. Duluth has chosen just to use the criteria that the state has developed. But we approached the Minneapolis and St. Paul community development programs to see if they would be willing or interested in modifying their qualified allocation plans. And so we went to one of the city council people in St. Paul, and she was interested because she had been approached previously about going down the line of some of the counties and cities in California that have mandated a certain percentage of units be smoke-free, and she didn't think that the city was ready for that strenuous regulation. But the tax credits are kind of a middle-of-the-road option because it doesn't require units to be smoke-free. It just provides an incentive to developers or investors to go smoke-free. So no requirement, just a little push in the direction we want them to head. So we talked to her, and she brought it before the Community Development Board that's responsible for making the new allocation plan. And both Minneapolis and St. Paul decided to adopt 1 point. as part of their allocation plans for smoke-free housing or smoke-free policy. Now, one of the questions I get frequently is, well, how much does one point make in these qualified allocation plans? And it seems to make quite a bit of difference. In Maine, I think the last round they did in 2008 or 2009, 100% of the applications for these tax credits, the development had included that 1 point for a smoke-free policy. I think in California it was around 50% of the applications included it. Here in Minneapolis and St. Paul, we've only had one round, and in the last round for Minneapolis, we had 9 total applicants. 3 of those chose the point for a smoke-free policy, and one of the 3 was selected to receive tax credits. And in St. Paul, we had 4 total applicants. 1 chose the point and did receive some credits for 2009. So it seems like it is, even though it's only 1 point, and some of the other criteria can be like 5 to 10 points, it does seem to make a difference. It does seem to give a competitive advantage, and so we think it's a useful tool. One of the kind of drawbacks to the low-income housing tax credit program right now has to do with the economy. A couple years ago, the rate that developers or investors were willing to pay for these tax credits was approximately 95 cents on the dollar, because they have to apply them over a 10-year period. They can't apply them all at once. And so they're discounted slightly. So they were paying around 95 cents on the dollar. But with the current economy and the slowdown in development, and probably a lot of the companies are experiencing losses anyway, so they're not going to be having a lot of tax burden. Right now, from what we're hearing, is there's not much use of this program at the moment. And those who are getting involved are paying about 75 cents on the dollar. So in a good economy, I think it's a great program, and it seems to have attracted a lot of involvement. But right now, it's I think, slowed down a little bit. So,
great. Warren, to obtain the information about what local communities can provide tax credits, you went to the state organization. Is that correct?
That's correct. And here was the Minnesota Housing Financing Agency. Again, in Colorado, it's Colorado Housing and Finance Authority. I did go to their website and looked at their allocation plan, but when I was going through it, I didn't see any information that indicated they had sub-allocators, that there were certain cities and counties within the state that the state organization then would give the tax credits to. But you might want to look a little farther. It may not have just been obvious when I did the first one.
We call them CHAFA out here.
Oh, okay.
For sure. And I have worked with some people there. So it's something worth looking into. We are currently working with Jefferson County on their ARRA application. And we're considering doing tax credits, but we found out that that county does not locally provide tax credits. They get all their tax credits through the state organization. So it may be somewhat limited to some of the larger local communities.
Yeah, and that's true here. I mean, Washington and Dakota County, they're one of the metro counties that are kind of booming with suburban development right now.
Yeah. And Jefferson County is pretty big, too, but maybe not comparatively.
Okay. And, yeah, and the five cities are the five largest cities in Minnesota. So.
All right, we'll go ahead and open up the questions. Anybody have some questions about low-income housing tax credits and how they work?
Pete, this is Jill. How often do states or localities redo their qualified allocation plan?
Here in Minnesota, they do it once a year, but they take applications for development twice a year. But they usually redevelop and consider new criteria around the first of the year to maybe around March. And they generally have to go before, like, the city or county board for approval.
Okay, good.
And that's true here in Colorado as well. The CHAFA every year does review their plan and considers different options. Last time I checked, you almost have to do it a year in advance to get even in.
Yeah. We haven't had much luck with the two counties that we've dealt with, Washington and Dakota. And just the two big cities here so far, right now we're expanding with some of the SHIP money into the county where where St. Cloud is located. So it could be on our we could be approaching them pretty soon to see if they would consider it as well. If you wanted to, you know, learn more basics on the program, there's actually a great series of web pages on HUD's website that kind of takes you through the steps of how they calculate how much money goes to an investor and how the tax credits are applied. It's actually a pretty useful kind of self-learning tool.
That sounds great. I'll check that out. Thank you.
Okay.
Does anybody else have any questions? All right. Well, that was very useful, Warren. Let's go on to the next topic then. So tell us a little bit about disclosure laws for our multi-unit housing, how it's been designed and implemented in local communities and states, et cetera, and how it's being proposed in Duluth, et cetera.
Sure. The disclosure laws or the proposals have developed I think I started working on them shortly after I got here and started working on leases, and I noticed that in the standard lease that's prepared by our buyer association, there's a required disclosure for lead paint for any buildings built before 1978, and that is a federal law that requires that, so it's mandated for all leases across the country. Here in Minnesota, we also have another required disclosure. And that's if a property has been previously used as a methamphetamine lab, as part of the disclosure during the course of sale, that the seller is required to disclose that. So I was starting to think about, well, wouldn't, with the recent Surgeon General's information on the dangers of secondhand smoke and ASHRAE's finding that you really can't control it through ventilation, wouldn't it make sense that landlords or sellers of condominiums are required to disclose if the property has a smoking permitted policy and where the units are that might be smoke non-smoking and smoke-free. And so I started drafting an article, and I think Pete might have shared it with you, or I can certainly send it out, which explains kind of the theory behind it and why we think it would be useful. Some of the reasons I think it would be useful, one, when we go out and speak to landlords, we frequently get questions about whether going smoke-free is legal, even though, I think it's very clear to all of us who are kind of in the community that, you know, we know very well that across the country it's legal to do it. Certain landlords still think it might be considered discriminatory. So having this statement in the lease saying, you know, let us know if you're smoking permitted or smoking prohibited, this is kind of an education tool for a lot of landlords. As far as tenants, I think it's beneficial because I've gotten several calls from individuals who state when they went to look at an apartment, they didn't notice any smoke smell, and it seemed fine to them, and the landlord didn't mention anything about the neighbor below or the neighbor on either side was a smoker. And then maybe it could also happen that that would be true for a while, and then subsequently a tenant would move in and start smoking right next to them. So if there's a statement in there that the landlord does permit smoking, it will at least make the tenant aware that it's not a smoke-free building. I think some of the concerns that have been raised are in regards to actions that a tenant might take if they're bothered by secondhand smoke. And the situation is sort of analogous to the warning label on the side of a cigarette pack, where right now even the new FDA bill prohibits lawsuits based on failure to warn or a duty to warn by a smoker against a tobacco company because of the labels that have been on the side of the packs. And some people are concerned that if this disclosure is included in a lease, then that would prohibit or kind of make it harder for a tenant to bring an action like a nuisance action against the landlord or a breach of the warranty of habitability action because a lot of secondhand smoke is coming into their unit because the landlord would counter with, well, you know, you signed the lease and the lease clearly states in there that smoking is prohibited in this complex and therefore you can't, you know, bring this action against me. And since we don't have a lot of histories, only a couple places have adopted disclosure policies, we don't know whether that would be used or not. I can see where landlords, the concerns we've heard initially from landlords is that they think having to disclose their policy would scare potential renters away. But in some ways, I mean, if we present it to them this way, it could be kind of a protection to them. They may see it as a way to prevent some tort actions or liabilities. So I think it's going to have to play out a little bit more to see what the effect will be. The two areas that have adopted it are Oakland, the city of Oakland, California, and the state of Oregon. In Oakland, rental apartment buildings are required to disclose the smoking policy for the complex and which units are smoke-free and which units are smoking permitted and where they are. Sellers of condominiums are also required to say whether the seller is required to disclose if the unit that's being sold is smoking permitted or smoking prohibited, as well as the smoking policy for the entire complex. And in Oregon, it's just been applied to apartments, and it requires landlords of rental buildings to disclose the policy and explain where the non-smoking units are and where the smoking units are. The Oregon law doesn't go into effect until January 1st of 2010, so we have no background on any enforcement issues. Oakland, California's has been in effect for about, I'd say, about a year and a half. And I followed up with Serena Chen out there, who's been involved in it, part of the ALA of California. And she hasn't had time to go back to see what any enforcement issues might be, but that's something that she's going to be doing in the future. So we might have some more information on how useful these are in the future. But at this point, we really don't have a lot of information we can share as far as enforcement issues or how effective it might be as an incentive.
Yeah, and you mentioned that one of the benefits is that helps landlords realize that this is legal, and this, I think, also with the low tax, low-income tax credits, it's also another educational opportunity to make people aware, oh, yes, I can do this.
Yeah,
you know, I've gotten complaints from people even who buy houses. There was one fellow who in Boulder County bought a house, and after moving in, the bathroom and the study next to it just stunk of tobacco smoke, and it was so bad that they couldn't even use the room. So I think for residents, it certainly has a benefit. But I mean, the question I have is, will it make a difference in terms of policy change, whether disclosure will have an effect in terms of more multi-unit communities going smoke-free? And as I emailed you earlier a few weeks ago, is that our state, before our Clean Indoor Air Act, had what we call a disclosure policy for restaurants and bars, where they had to put up a sign saying whether they had a no smoking section or not.
Yep.
And they put up, you know, they would put up the sign, but it didn't make a huge amount of difference in whether they actually put in a no smoking section or not. So,
okay,
you know, it'll be interesting to see whether these policies do help. On the other side, too, is that once you have those policies, will it discourage any strengthening of policies or delay policy? As you know, we had that law passed back in 1977, and it took till 2006 before we got our current Clean Indoor Air Act. And you know, for many years, people said, "Well, you know, it's all we already have a law; it's sort of voluntary," and you know, so.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. I know. I mean, we've been discussing whether we want to push this as a policy in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and that's primarily the reason why we're concerned, is that you may have a landlord who is concerned about liability because people smoke and he's heard of the dangers of secondhand smoke. So the individual may be thinking of adopting a smoke-free policy and then becomes aware of disclosure and thinks, well, you know, that's a step I could do instead. And so instead of going all the way to smoke-free, they might think of this as a sufficient interim step. So, yeah, I think we'll have to wait to see what the real impact is.
Great. Does anybody have any questions about disclosure laws that they would like to ask Warren? It's a quiet group today.
Everybody's on mute. So.
Do a half, about 15 seconds here in case anybody has any questions.
Okay.
All right, since there are no, and when we get done here, if you come up with a question that you haven't thought of earlier, we can ask them at the end as well. All right, so let's go on to the topic of enforcement. What are your recommendations for enforcing matchmaking policies in multi-unit housing?
Sure. If any of you were at the smoke-free ancillary meeting in Phoenix, I went over this a little bit at that session as well. So some of this might be familiar to you, but when we, this is probably the primary question we get when I go out and speak to landlords is the enforcement issue. They are very concerned that it will be an enforcement nightmare. They don't want to be acting as the police person and going around and trying to sniff out smoke. They're very concerned about, you know, if they do try to bring an eviction action against a tenant, how do they prove it? And so these are some of the things I go over with them when we talk about it. And first, the experience that we've had in Minnesota, and I think it's generally around the country as well, that enforcement of smoke-free policies is not a huge issue. I mean, we've had a few cases here in Minnesota where a landlord has had to evict a tenant, coupled with public housing authorities, but they're very rare. The downside of that is we don't have a lot of case history, if you do end up having to go to court, to show what kinds of proof a landlord might need to bring to show or to satisfy the court that there's been a breach of a smoke-free policy. But the other concern is that I think the discussion unnecessarily turns into an adversarial kind of discussion when you talk about enforcement, because I think actually the majority of the parties involved in smoke-free housing are all on the same side. I think landlords benefit by reducing the cost of turning over an apartment, reducing the risk of fire damage. The tenants are majority from all surveys in favor of smoke-free policies. So it's generally the minority that are causing that people are concerned about, and probably justifiably so because they'll be raising an issue. But I think a lot of times we just discussion immediately goes kind of to an adversarial position, but that's understandable. So some of the things we recommend when we're talking to landlords, kind of a three-step procedure as far as establishment, is to prepare everyone, document everything, and then enforce every violation. And so in other words, make the individuals, both the landlords and the owners and property managers, make them all aware of this new policy being implemented, have presentations to them, share information, and do it well in advance. And so this, we frequently recommend a year to 6 months, start talking about it and get people's feedback. And do the same for the tenants. I mean, start having information meetings, doing surveys to find out what their attitude is. I mean, if you have a significant portion who are against it, maybe it's not the right time to move forward with it. But a lot of times we find that people overestimate the number of smokers in their building. And so, and also frequently some of the smokers would prefer to have a smoke-free environment themselves. Then document everything. We have on our website a smoke-free lease addendum that we recommend that landlords use. And it's available. It came about as a result of other attorneys working on a study from back in 2001, 2002. And it has a lot of provisions in there that both help the tenant as well as the landlord. One of the things it has in there is it's protection of the landlord. It says the landlord is not guaranteeing a smoke-free environment. The landlord is just using a best effort. And the landlord also needs assistance from other tenants in case the tenants are aware of smoking incidents, but the landlord is not. It's up to the tenants to inform them that the landlord that an infraction has occurred. The addendum we use also allows the tenant to be a third-party beneficiary of the lease. So in other words, a tenant can bring an action directly against another tenant for violation of the lease. The tenant doesn't have to, the non-smoking tenant doesn't have to go to the landlord directly. They can bring an action directly against the other tenant. They can't evict the other tenant, but they can get an injunction that would order the smoking tenant to cease the smoking to adhere to the policy. So we make sure that they document everything specifically. As far as enforcement, kind of the three rules to remember are, one, enforce promptly. Courts generally will look at actions over a period of time to see whether the lease is enforceable. So if a landlord knows that an infraction is incurring and yet continues to accept monthly rent from the tenant who's smoking in violation of the lease, the court may consider the smoke-free policy to have been waived and therefore not enforce it. Similarly, you should enforce it uniformly. So, in other words, enforce the same penalties against all tenants. So don't, if the landlord has friends or relatives who are renting a unit, don't enforce the policy against the strangers, but then allow your relatives or your friends to get away with smoking. For the same reason, the courts will say you're not enforcing it uniformly, therefore we consider the policy to have been waived, and therefore it's not enforceable against anyone. And also enforce it consistently, which means don't just enforce it in the winter when everyone's windows are closed and it's most noticeable, but enforce it any season. And again, for the same reason, if you don't enforce it consistently, then the courts a lot of times will just say, well, then the policy is ineffective and won't enforce it at all. So if you do end up having to take action against a tenant, it's good to gather a lot of information. What you might want to do, and what especially a lot of housing authorities do, is they have three violations before an eviction action will occur. And so they have a couple of notice of infractions, and then on the third one, they will take the or pursue an eviction action against the tenant. I was talking with a referee in our housing court, and his recommendation was to get witnesses. So the more witnesses to the smoking incident that you can bring into court, the more persuaded he would be as far as enforcing the smoke-free policy. So those are a couple of recommendations. The enforcement policy, one thing to be aware of, or the enforcement steps, will vary based on whether it's a market rate building or whether it's some form of federally subsidized housing. Some of the Section 8 property or public housing, they have a grievance process that the owners or the managers have to go through if there's a violation of the lease. So it's a little more strenuous as far as evicting or taking action against tenants in federally subsidized housing, and it can vary based on whether it's a public housing authority or Section 8. So those are a couple of things to that's another thing to remember. As far as tenants who might need resources if they're, say, trying to enforce a policy that's not being enforced by the landlords, they have some resources, some legal aid, depending on their income level might help them. There are attorney referral services that are available in a lot of counties and cities. And here at Mitchell, we also have a clinic that works with low-income individuals, and one of the types of cases that they take are housing cases. So those are some of the other resources that are available for the tenant side. And it could be available for the landlord side. They're usually income-based, so it depends on how much they're making. So.
Great. You mentioned a website. Is it mnsmokefreehousing.org? Is that correct?
That's the Live Smoke Free Program's website here in Minnesota. And if you go to that website and then go to the landlord, there will be a secondary button, the landlord button. That's where you could find a copy of the smoke-free lease addendum that we use here.
Okay.
And they also have, there's a tenant button that you can go to, and it has steps that tenants can take if they're being bothered by secondhand smoke and some of what their legal rights are.
Great. And again, for those on the phone, it's MN, like the abbreviation for Minnesota, smokefreehousing.org. Are there any questions about enforcement from anybody on the call?
I have one.
Could you please state your name and agency again?
That's Barbara Glick. We're for Volunteers of America. We're a PRAC 202 HUD housing for seniors. We went non-smoking. We gave the residents about 9 months to before we went finally non-smoking. But I have about three that are continually smoke. And when I go to talk on their door, you know, knock on the door and say, you know, I can smell smoke out here, they deny it. How do you handle this when they deny it right to your face?
Yeah, and see, this will be an ongoing problem when they deny it to you. I just had an individual call yesterday where the person is claiming it's just visitors who are smoking in their unit and not the individual themselves. Again, I mean, it's the process would be to try to build as much evidence as you can. I mean, if you give them several notice of infractions, and then if you have to end up going to court or through the grievance process, show them that you warned them several times. If you can get any individual on adjacent units to testify as well, that would be helpful. But it is a challenge to try to build enough evidence to be persuasive. And I think it's especially a challenge when you're working in subsidized housing with low-income individuals because, smoking incidence is higher in the low-income population, although I think the perception of how much higher it is a little inaccurate. But, you know, we had one incident here where a public housing authority was the person was continuing to smoke in violation of the policy, and so they started the grievance process and then the eviction procedures, and someone on the city council found out about it and raised quite a issue about pushing low-income people out into the street. It eventually resolved itself when other residents in the building spoke of their own health issues that were being affected by exposure to secondhand smoke. And one of the commissioners on the HRA or Housing Redevelopment Board was a nurse and was also able to advocate it. And they were able to successfully evict the person. But that is going to be the ongoing challenge.
Thank you.
Yeah. One possibility, it just depends on how much you want to spend on documentation. And we've had this problem come up in some other communities. And, again, if you can get neighbors that can say that, you know, I smell the smoke, that I think is really helpful. But worst comes to worst, there is something called a passive nicotine monitor that can be placed outside the unit for a month, and it will gather proof that smoking is coming from the apartment. But those things can be expensive, and it does cost to, number one, get the monitors and then to have the testing done. And there is a fellow in Maryland who does provide that service for $600. So there is that option. There are some other devices that can also do that, but they're not quite as effective as a passive nicotine monitor.
Yeah. We have an organization here that I'm actually working with on the condominium study. They're called the Center for Energy and Environment, and they were partners on the earlier research done on exposure of secondhand smoke in rental apartments, and they provide some of those services too. They have a device called an ethylometer, which can be placed in a unit, and it is pretty sensitive, much more so than other units called like a side pack or something. But again, it's expensive, but they're a nonprofit funded by grants and research, and so they were able to help with the condominium situation where an individual in a condominium has experienced secondhand smoke coming up from the unit below, and they were able to monitor it and demonstrate that secondhand smoke and all the chemicals associated was coming in and help persuade the condominium board to take action. So,
you suggest doing write-ups to write a lease infraction up, even though they deny it?
I would suggest you do that. Yeah, document as much as you can. I mean, you could try to get them to sign it saying this is your first warning, but if the individual is adamant, I would say still do as much documentation or statements from others as you can. So, again, we don't have a lot of case history to go on. So, and also landlord-tenant law, unfortunately, is different from state to state. For instance, I was looking at Pete forwarded to me the habitability statute, and it looks like in Colorado it can really only be used as a defense in case a tenant is being evicted for certain actions. Whereas here in Minnesota, we have something called a rent escrow action that can be used as an offense by tenants who are being bothered by secondhand smoke. And kind of the benefit of that is a lot of the tenant screening services, when they go to courts to try to look at the records to find out whether the tenant has been problematic in the past, is they generally look for where the tenant is a defendant in the case and not a plaintiff. And so if the tenant takes a rent escrow action, they're listed as a plaintiff, and so the screening companies usually don't come up with those, from what I understand, and so they wouldn't be seen as a risk by future landlords.
I went to a conference in Dallas 2 weeks ago, and we had a fair housing attorney talk to all the Volunteers of America across the United States, and he said all the lawsuits from non-smokers being filed against the apartments, they were winning every single case.
Okay, good.
Barb, where are you from?
Durango.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, and I think that what's helpful is, of course, the Surgeon General's report from 2006, but then, as probably everyone's aware, this past summer we had a number of documents come out from the federal government, the Surgeon General's call to action for healthy homes, and then HUD's healthy home strategic plan, and then the HUD notice strongly encouraging public housing authorities to go smoke-free. So I think, you know, judges and people who are not directly involved in the community are becoming just more and more aware of the dangers of secondhand smoke. So it would probably be easier for a judge to be to rule for the non-smoker than it might have been in the past. So, because some of the cases that we have in some of our publications, the judges have said, well, you know, living in an apartment building, you just have to put up with other odors. And they classify it as an odor, not necessarily as a health hazard. But I think that's changing.
Warren, I'm trying to remember, can HUD properties or Section 8 properties, can they in their lease have fines for violations of policy? I can't remember.
Yeah, I know that public housing authorities can't. As project-based Section 8, HUD would have to prove any extra charges. It's not specifically listed. But I don't think I was able to find anything on the Housing Choice Voucher or the tenant-based Section 8. But I think, yeah, for project-based, they would have to get approval for fines.
Right. Is that in terms of we've also found with landlords, if there is a – you know, for instance, a lot of them will say warning first, and then second time you get fined. And
yeah.
That's been, usually once the fine's imposed, there's never, ever another violation. So sometimes having that fine for violations can be a huge way to enforce as well.
Sure, yep.
This is Jan Morcheski, tobacco-free Larimer County up in Fort Collins, and I have – this is kind of a real specific example. But is it – when it comes to a housing unit that has a policy, is it up to the tenants to inform any visitors? And this is the scenario. I got a call yesterday from a caregiver from elderly tenants in this housing unit. There's a smoke-free policy. This woman's a caregiver. Another caregiver hired by her agency is violating the policy.
Mm-hmm.
And these are older folks who are very debilitated, so probably don't have much ability to advocate for themselves without help, or say to the landlord or to the employer, look, they're violating this policy. So the smoke is making the caregiver sick, the resident sick, but she just kind of doesn't know what to do and doesn't really want to be the person going to the landlord or to her employer. But my suggestion is it's kind of like a workplace issue now, and that she needs to go to her employer. But so I guess I'm asking the question about whose responsibility is to make sure that visitors are not smoking in a place that has a policy.
Yeah, in most cases, the leases I've seen, it's up to the tenant to inform guests and visitors that a non-smoking policy is in place.
Uh-huh.
When it's an employee situation or something like that, or an individual who is hesitant to enforce it, I would say that going to the landlord would be the next step.
Uh-huh.
And having the landlord inform them that the grounds or the units are smoke-free. Or, you know, also raising it like you suggested with the employer. But in most cases, yeah, the responsibility rests with the tenant. And, of course, that being, you can write your smoke release addendum. You have a lot of flexibility on how you want to write it, but that's the way I've seen it the most often.
Is there any kind of signs in her apartment indicating that there's no smoking? I mean, that's another way that you could enforce it quietly.
Yeah. This woman said it's in the policy, but, yeah, it's unfortunate because it's affecting the clients who don't have a lot of ability to advocate. It's affecting the caregiver, and it just is an interesting situation where caregivers often in situations like this could be violating policies without even knowing that there is a policy if nobody tells them. But the signage is a good idea because that would make it more obvious.
Yeah. The other thing that here in Minnesota, I'm not sure of your statewide smoke-free law or clean indoor air law, but here we have a smoke-free workplace law where more than one individual is working in an enclosed area that is considered a place of employment. So I don't know whether I haven't heard of it being brought up here, but if you have two caregivers then in an individual's unit, I mean, I wonder if the argument could be made that at that time then it's could be considered a place of employment, and that would be a violation of state law.
Yeah, and I thought of that, but I don't think it would fall under our Clean Indoor Air Act.
Okay.
But Jill and Pete, you might think differently.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you might also look at if it's in Fort Collins, the local law as well. So.
Yeah, it wouldn't be covered under our ordinance.
Yeah, our workplace law is 3, but it has to be a workplace. It can't be a workplace if it's accessed by the public, it is under the state law.
Right.
So,
yeah, this is still, I've been thinking about looking into that a little bit more in reference to smoke-free patios, restaurants, you know, that have the patio. In one part of the law it talks about an employee's assigned workspace. Well, if that patio is with the tables they're covering tonight, that's their assigned workplace. But there are other, like Pete says, there are other things that talk about. It has to be open to the public. It has to have 3 or more employees. You know, there's a few other things. But that is worth looking at more, too. So that's interesting.
Thank you.
Sure. Any more questions about enforcement?
This is John from Denver Public Health. I had a question. Earlier he talked about how when people in the housing industry and tenants get together, there becomes an adversarial relationship. We have a Denver smoke-free housing forum tomorrow, which is primarily aimed at people in the housing industry, but I have 2 people who have invited themselves to the forum. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on how do I keep them from having a Jerry Springer moment.
I guess, I don't know, are you speaking or are you kind of introducing or leading the session?
The way these tend to work is we have people who are from the housing industry who have gone smoke-free talk about what they did, how they did it, the enforcement, any policies that they have, and then we have people who are there who are interested in that subject who are part of the housing industry. We generally don't have tenants come to this. We have had in the past, but these tenants were already living in smoke-free housing, so they were okay. The 2 that are coming, one is having a problem with his landlord, and he wants the place to go to smoke-free, and the other one currently lives in the place where we're having this meeting tomorrow.
Okay.
So I'm not leaving. I will be there.
Okay. I guess, if you could start off, or the individual who's speaking could start off by explaining how smoke-free policies are a benefit to everyone. And again, one of the things we stress when we're speaking to various groups is that we're not targeting specific individuals, we're targeting an activity. And so therefore, we're not saying smokers can't live here, we're just saying take your activity to the appropriate location. So whether it's off the grounds or to a designated area on the ground, I mean, as long as you can do that, you know, we're fine. And even a lot of smokers agree with that. And also they, especially now in condominium units, they don't want to damage their unit because they're concerned about reselling. But if I guess frame it as much as possible as a benefit to everyone involved, and that it is a minority who are opposed to these kinds of policies.
I think if I'm correct, Don, these are people who are actually non-smokers who want policy change. Did I get that right?
The ones who will be there tomorrow, that is correct.
Okay, so it's mainly the landlords who might be opposed to it?
Well, see, we've had landlords who have shown up, and they've shown up, and they've had questions, and they're basically the same questions. They just haven't moved forward, and we're hoping that they don't feel attacked.
My thought is that when you start the meeting, you just need to clarify what the meeting is and what the purpose of the meeting is, just so that those people, that those tenants, residents that are there for the meeting, just to make it clear what it's for and what the purpose of the meeting is, and that it's not a place necessarily for, you know, residents to come and change policy, but as a meeting for landlords to discuss, you know, the problems and issues and benefits, et cetera.
Yeah, and I think some of the most persuasive evidence is we have some statistics on what it costs to clean an apartment or turn over apartment, replacing carpeting. One individual had to replace the refrigerator because they said every time they opened the freezer, it smelled like somebody had been smoking in the freezer. And the other very convincing advocates when it comes to landlords or other landlords, we frequently have a booth at the Minnesota Multi-Housing Show, which is primarily directed at smaller landlords, not big property management companies. But we had one individual who came to our session and then converted to smoke-free and just loves it as far as ease of, you know, cleaning and just better environment. And sometimes just hangs by our booth, and then if other landlords come up and have questions and says, you know, well, I'm not sure I can do that. This other landlord has been very helpful as far as being an advocate and saying, you've got to try it. You know, the concerns you have, you know, are not that valid or not as so I think getting an ally from the landlord population is a good tool too.
Okay,
why don't we go ahead? We have about 30 more minutes, so let's go ahead and move on here. So the next topic to discuss are what are some of the challenging legal questions for landlords. So kind of goes right into the question that we're just discussing in terms of some of disability accommodations, how to address some of these other issues.
Yeah, one of the questions we get frequently from landlords, and in particular ones who might be or managers of public housing authorities or subsidized housing, is we have individuals who have mobility disability who are wheelchair bound and cannot get outside. They're interested in having a smoke-free policy, but they're concerned about a certain segment of their population who that may be difficult for. And they want to know also whether HUD or the courts might consider an individual's smoking habit or addiction to nicotine as a disability, and they would have to accommodate that disability by allowing them to smoke inside. And a couple of the responses, we've seen only a few cases that involve disability accommodations, and they're generally on the other side. Generally, they're an individual who is a non-smoker with a condition such as asthma or emphysema or some heart or other lung-related conditions, or asking an accommodation to prohibit smoking. I haven't seen a successful one from a smoker. There is a case where actually it was a prisoner who brought a court case saying, I'm addicted to nicotine, addicted to smoking cigarettes. The prison has passed a no-smoking policy. I'm requesting an accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities Act, you know, and your accommodation is to allow me to continue to smoke in my cell. And the court said, no, that's not valid, because what they usually consider our disabilities are conditions that are fairly unchangeable or kind of permanent and kind of small in population. They said there's so much evidence now of people successfully giving up smoking that it's not kind of a permanent condition or something, you know, you can't change. And also they were saying if we did this, if we consider smoking a disability, then we would be considering about a quarter, I think 25% of the population of the country would then be considered disabled. should not allow that to go forward. As far as trying to address a mobility disability, there's another part of the American Disabilities Act or the Fair Housing Act. There are actually three acts that address disability. One would be the Americans with Disabilities Act, and that's primarily public accommodations such as places of employment or restaurants. The Federal Rehabilitation Act, and that applies to any place that gets federal funds. And then the Federal Fair Housing Act, and that's the one most likely used because it applies to almost all housing except like rental units with four or fewer units where the owner lives in one. But as far as a wheelchair-bound individual or some other mobility disability being allowed to smoke in their unit as opposed to having to go outside to a shelter, the law says there has to be a direct nexus or connection between the disability and the accommodation that's being requested. And even though we haven't seen it tried in court, my assumption is that, or the way I lean, is that a provision allowing them to smoke inside is not directly connected enough to their disability. The accommodations you usually see are ramps or wider doors or elevators, so that's directly related to their mobility condition, whereas smoking is just an activity that they're engaged in that they want to do inside just because it might be more difficult for them to get outside, but it's not directly related to their condition. I think one of the challenges that comes up in regards to disability is when you have individuals with mental health issues. And we know statistically that individuals with mental health issues smoke at a considerably higher rate than individuals who don't have those conditions. And so we haven't seen a request yet, but this could be a challenging one where individuals with mental health conditions want to self-medicate by using cigarettes and are requesting an accommodation to allow them to continue to smoke in their unit. I suppose the argument could be made that they're capable of going outside, so they can certainly smoke there. Another provision of the Fair Housing Act says that you don't have to provide housing to an individual whose activity could impact the health of another resident. And so under that provision, too, I could see that this accommodation wouldn't necessarily have to be made. But it's, again, one we haven't seen it tested yet. One of my concerns is some of the ordinances are now being passed in some of the cities and counties of California. One of the exceptions that they're making in some of these ordinances is allowing individuals who smoke medical marijuana for a condition. That's one of the exceptions in their law. And so I have concerns about that because we don't know, I think, enough yet about the secondhand smoke involved with medical marijuana. And so this is kind of an area that's indefinite yet, and so we don't know exactly how it'll be treated, but we'll see. The other question we get for landlords is liability. They're concerned initially that if they adopt a smoke-free policy and then unbeknownst to them, one of the units gets rented out to a smoker and then they're adjacent to an individual who might have a health condition and the individual gets sick and then sues the landlord saying, you said this was a smoke-free building, and then I got sick because this person is smoking next to me. And that's one of the one of the reasons in our lease addendum we have the language saying that the landlord is not a guarantee of a healthier environment or a smoke-free environment. It's just a best effort on the part of the landlord. And the landlord also has to enlist the assistance of other tenants to inform the landlord because the landlord couldn't take any action if they don't know that the individual is smoking. And so actually what I think we're probably going to see is in the future are more potential liability for a landlord if they don't adopt a smoke-free policy. As more information gets out there about the dangers of secondhand smoke, I could see landlords who are aware of smoking and aware of the dangers, an individual start, bringing action saying, well, you know of the risk and you didn't warn me of it when I rented this apartment and you knew these people were smoking. Therefore, it was a failure to warn, and therefore you might have some liability. So those are some of the questions that we get when we go out and address landlords groups.
You want to talk a little bit about disparate treatment, retaliation, and policy waivers?
Yeah, disparate treatment, that's why what we recommend when we go to landlords that they therapy based on the activity and not the individual status of the smoker. Even though we have case law that shows that an individual's status as a smoker is not a protected category of person, such as ethnicity or race or national origin, our concern is that if a landlord adopts a policy based on a person's status, we do have a couple categories of persons, or maybe more than a couple, who do smoke at a higher rate than the average population. Native Americans smoke at a much higher rate. As I mentioned before, individuals with mental health issues smoke at a much higher rate, and those are protected categories or could be protected categories. And so a claim could be brought, potentially be brought against the landlord saying, well, the person would claim, you're not renting to me, not because I'm a smoker, but because I'm a member of one of these categories that does receive protection. And so that's why we, to prevent any of that kind of challenge, we recommend that you do it based on the activity and say, you know, we rent to anyone as long as you adhere to our policy around the activity and take it outside or take it to the shelter, and then you're fine, we'll rent to anyone. So that helps prevent any kind of those kind of challenges. The retaliation issue would help because we had a concern on another conference call I was on that what if you have situations such as they do in California or New York with rent control where an individual or a landlord is trying to get rid of certain individuals because maybe their rent is so low and so they want to institute a policy to get rid of just certain individuals. Well, we have a policy here in Minnesota where is if a tenant asserts a right, in this case it could be a warranty of habitability claim because a lot of smoke is coming in or some other right or challenge that they could make. Here in Minnesota, if the landlord takes action against that individual within 90 days of the tenant asserting their right, then the assumption is that the landlord is retaliating against the individual. And therefore, it's up to the landlord to prove that it's not a retaliatory action. After 90 days and the assumption flips the other way, then it's up to the tenant to prove that it was retaliation against them asserting their right and to succeed in a case against the landlord. And the policy waiver part of it was what I referred to earlier, where landlords have to be ensured that they enforce consistently, uniformly, and all, you know, and against all infractions, and don't wait a long time, or otherwise courts might consider the policy to have been waived.
Excellent. Are there any questions about some of the challenging legal questions for landlords from anybody on the call?
Do you see smokers ever becoming a protected group?
You know, I don't. When you look at legal cases around protected groups, they generally have like 2 to 3 criteria as far as what categories of persons courts are going to protect and provide what they call strict scrutiny for any laws against them. And usually they consider it what's called an immutable characteristic, which means something you're born with and is not easily changed. And it has to be something that, well, something like, it, even though that there's a some exceptions to that, it's generally something that a person is born with, such as national origin or race, ethnicity, before they'll give it the highest level of scrutiny or highest level of protection. And so I don't think someone's habits as a smoker would be given the same protection because, one, they're not born with it, and, two, it's something that is changeable from the evidence of all the people going off smoking. So the one exception in what usually gets protection is religion. I mean, because religion is obviously something, I mean, you could be considered you're born with, but it's not immutable, as a lot of people, you know, might change their choice of religion. But that's probably the only characteristic that might be, or category that does get protection, that it might be somewhat similar to a person's status as a smoker. But I just don't see it happening, no.
Okay. However, on the other hand, there is case law of non-smokers being able to use the Fair Housing Act because they have a medical condition that affects them.
Correct.
So there's more likelihood of problems having in that direction.
Yep.
Well,
we have a couple of papers on that. Are there any other questions on that issue?
Yeah, we had a case here for a lady. She was 87 years old and smoked most of her life. And when we went non-smoking, she said she couldn't go outside because she was too old and blah, blah, blah. And they actually went to an attorney, and she said that her doctor said that advised her not to quit smoking because of her age.
Wow. Okay.
But they did move. But
okay.
We almost got sued by them, but I don't think they had any really rights.
Yeah, no. I mean, as far as I know, that's the first time, or I don't know what the medical justification would be. That's beyond me, but I'm surprised to hear that. So.
Well, we were too.
Yeah, I mean, because generally what you hear, you can see health benefits when you quit at any age. So.
This is John from Denver Public Health. They may have been concerned of her going through the withdrawals and the nicotine withdrawals.
Oh, okay.
That's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah.
I wonder if that doctor was willing to put it down on paper and sign his or her name that they were stating that. I'm suspicious that that is not something that a doctor would do.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, because there are a lot of this, you know, the patches and other cessation products that might have been assistance to the withdrawal issue.
You know, well, never, yeah.
Were you about to say something? Do we lose people? Hello?
Not me.
Okay. That's right. Well, let's go ahead and move on to the final question here. What are some of the options a resident could pursue for legal assistance in resolving problems with tobacco smoke intrusion and then multi-unit housing?
Yeah. There are kind of a number of what I call common law claims that a tenant can bring, and probably you're aware of many of them, such as a nuisance action, or in some states, even smoke can be considered trespass because of the particulate matter that's moving from one unit to another. So some states just consider secondhand smoke as an odor, and so it's not a trespass. So of course, you have the some states have a common law warranty of habitability. Here in Minnesota, it's also in statute, and so they could bring an action under that statute or common law claim. And in certain cases, there's also been a harassment issue brought. The issue that we find a lot with tenants who call is there's a, and it's probably a fairly large segment of them who are, it's difficult for them to get some of the assistance that they need. If you're below a certain income level, then you can get legal aid services. Here in Minnesota, most of the legal aid services are available to residents who make 125% or less of the federal poverty guidelines, but that's very low income. I think it's around $12,000 a year in order to qualify. And unfortunately, with this economy the way it is right now, a lot of the legal aid services have had to cut back. We've actually had a couple of them have closed. And so, you know, whether this would get someone, a legal aid attorney would be able to provide assistance to an individual tenant who is getting secondhand smoke, I don't know. It's difficult. We have one organization here which is non-income based called Homeline, and they will provide services to any tenant regardless of their income level. And they have received calls from secondhand smoke, people affected by secondhand smoke, and they have recommended some of the rent escrow actions, which I mentioned before, where they'll actually the tenant will initiate an action and bring the landlord to court. Some of the other options for individuals who may be making too much for legal aid attorneys is we have attorney referral services, and generally they're very reasonable, if not free. The attorney services for the Minnesota State Bar Association referral services, the individual gets the first half hour for free, and then after that they would have to talk about a fee with the attorney. For some of our counties, the first half hour is around $30, and then after that they have to negotiate a fee with the attorney. Problem with this kind of option, though, again, is that these are not cases that are likely to earn the attorney much money. And so if the solution is not something that the attorney can address within the first half hour or give suggestions, sometimes they think it's probably pretty limited that the attorney might take the case. The other option is a lot of our law firms, the larger law firms here in the city, have community involvement or pro bono activities that they'll get involved in. One of them was very heavily involved in housing issues. They were actually involved in what's called this medical legal partnership, where if an individual presented themselves at a hospital or emergency room with a condition that was exacerbated by exposure to secondhand smoke, then the physician would actually contact the volunteer attorney at the firm and get the attorney involved right away. And so they didn't have to wait for the patient to, you know, have the time to contact the attorney or find out where they needed to go. The doctor legal relationship with the attorney would be initiated right off the bat. And so then the attorney could be brought in for no cost to help advise the patient about possible legal remedies. So that's another option. And you could also look for, tenants could look for options at local law schools to see if there are law students who might be able to help. I know our Homeline agency, who provides services to tenants without the criteria of an income level, they have a lot of law students who volunteer there during the course of the law school year. So the other options for tenants who may not be able to afford an attorney or not find a volunteer one are the disability statutes, either the federal or state disability statutes. Again, the most frequently used one would probably be the Fair Housing Act, because it applies to almost all forms of housing. Here in Minnesota, we also have our human rights statute that has disability included as a protected category. And so if the tenant has a condition that could be qualified as a disability, then they would get protection under the state statute as well. The concern with those is that they're decided on a case-by-case basis. And so individuals who may have gotten relief with asthma in one situation, it's not a guarantee that another individual with asthma would get the same relief in different situations. And also the accommodation that might be offered under disability statutes can vary as well. We have seen cases where the accommodation that HUD has required has been the imposition of a smoke-free policy, but it could be others. It could be the offer of moving the smoking tenant or physical attempts to seal up the unit. So it's not a guarantee of what the accommodation would be. But it's something that, you know, is worth trying, and most of those can be done for no cost. HUD actually has a form that you can fill out online, and they're fairly responsive. I think they have to get back, or they're committed to getting back to the individual complainant within 10 days. And so that's an option. And we have a HUD memo also that shows that one condition that might get relief is something called a multiple chemical sensitivity disorder. And they said if an individual suffers from that, then exposure to secondhand smoke could be something that triggers them an accommodation. One of the things I've seen mentioned actually in one of our synopses is possibly turning to city, county health, sanitation, or health codes. And I've done some looking into that, and so far I don't know whether that's a really good option for tenants, because most of the nuisance provisions apply to what are called public nuisances. So it would generally be a situation where maybe a business is burning a lot of refuse outside and it's affecting a lot of people, and then the city could come after the business and saying, you're causing a public nuisance based on your burning of this trash or garbage. But it doesn't usually apply to in case of private nuisance, which is, you know, smoke moving from one unit to another within an apartment building. And as far as sanitation goes, most of those apply to, like, non-usable, you know, plumbing or hot water or heat or something, especially like here in Minnesota. But I haven't seen situations where I think they can be really used to prohibit secondhand smoke from unit to unit. And it's kind of disappointing, because from what I've read, the administrative procedures to enforce city or county sanitation codes are a lot easier for individuals to implement or to access. It doesn't require an attorney. It's more of an administrative procedure, not a court one. So I'll keep looking at those to see if there's a way or if someone is innovative and can find a way to use those, because I think it might be another useful tool. But so far, I don't think they're a great option. So.
Yeah, it's I did do some research, and we do have a state nuisance law, and conceivably the way it's written, and we once had an assistant attorney general send us an opinion as to whether it could be used, and he said, well, yeah, you could use it, but the problem is, number one, the process of using it is not easy. It's complicated. I think, secondly, you have to look at the political ramifications of a health department coming in and saying, make this building smoke-free, and what kind of political ramifications that would create, not only locally, but whether it would have a ripple effect throughout the state when you're not quite really haven't started a statewide campaign on smoke-free housing that is really strong and widespread. So I think those are the other things to think about.
Yeah.
Are there any questions about some of the legal options for residents? I mean, we have used the Fair Housing Act a number of times, and we haven't really had much luck in terms with HUD, but sometimes in one case, and just even though because we filed it, it created such angst amongst the apartment community that got the complaint that they decided to go ahead and make the place smoke-free. Now,
yeah,
they've had some issues in terms of enforcement, but with HUD, so far, everybody that's filed has been turned down. Usually what they say is, well, you knew they allowed smoking when you moved in there, so, you don't have much of a case, which is kind of ridiculous, but that's what they've said, usually.
Yeah, that's something similar with the rent escrow action we have here. I think a lot of times it's one of its main benefits is a leverage to get the landlord to negotiate with the tenant. One individual I helped with is she filed one, or directly, I couldn't directly help, but suggested to. She filed a rent escrow action, and she went to court, and the landlord actually came to court and called her out into the hallway and they were able to come to an agreement. She was let out of her 6-month lease and allowed to go month to month until she could find a smoke-free place. So sometimes it's useful as leverage or a negotiating tool.
All right, we have about 5 more minutes left on the call for those of you that are still on it. Are there any further questions for Warren from anybody on the call?
I have one. Is there such thing as a grandfather clause?
Who is this again?
This is Barbara from Durango.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. As far as there's nothing as far as HUD requiring grandfathering in federally subsidized buildings, in their notice that they just came out with, they don't specify that, but we have a letter from the local Minneapolis HUD office saying they do not have a policy on grandfathering. Grandfathering is something that individual market rate apartment buildings can do if they want to. It's not something that's required, and it's actually something that if asked about, we generally discourage. Just because it can be, I mean, you're not getting the benefits of a smoke-free building, for one thing. You don't know in certain situations, unless you put a time limit on it, how long that individual will remain there, so your building could be in the same situation for a long time. And it could also present an enforcement issue. I mean, if you have, say, certain individuals grandfathered because they were residents before the policy went into effect, and then you have new residents move in next to them, you know, the new residents may be tempted to take advantage of their adjacent apartment and smoke in their unit and say, oh, no, it's coming from next door, it's not me who's smoking. And, you know, sometimes also, again, with the consistency issue for courts, they may have some issue, well, you know, you're letting certain residents smoke and not others, that's not really equitable, so, you know, we're going to have to, you know, remove the policy or something. So it is, it's definitely feasible, and for a lot of landlords, for purposes of equity or fairness, they think that's the way they initially want to implement it. But I think it definitely has issues.
Thank you.
Yep.
We, in Colorado, we discourage long-term grandfathering clauses as well, and we don't. What we recommend is that these clauses not take more than 1 year, because again, also it just it, when you have those, when people move in and they're told, well, you can't smoke, but these people can, it does set up some friction there. But if you can reduce it or keep it to a certain timeline, they say, okay, I'm willing to live with it for the next 6-7 months, as long as I know that by this date, the whole place is going to be non-smoking.
Yeah. Where it's actually become it's a very interesting issue is in the situation of condominiums, where people, as opposed to being on like a one-year rent, they purchased a unit, and then subsequent to that, maybe the condominium complex goes smoke-free, and they're saying, well, you know, I purchased this unit, and then subsequent to that, now you've implemented this policy, and you have no grandfathering provision. And actually, most of the states around the country say, well, you know, you bought the unit with information in the governing document saying that policies can be changed in the future if the, you know, majority of the homeowners agree. So therefore, you were put on notice when you purchased that the policies could change in the future. And so most state courts do enforce smoke-free policies that are implemented even after, you know, a smoker has purchased. So.
Are there any more questions? We have about 3 more minutes. All right.
Just one thing Pete, I noticed I sent to you the article that I had written on disclosure.
Sure.
Yeah, one other thing I had prepared when we were successful with getting the low-income housing tax credit program passed in Minneapolis and St. Paul is just a one-page breaking news article that we had posted on our website. So if people were interested in more information on that, I could send that to you, and then you could send it out to them.
Sure. I will send out the information to everybody on the list.
Okay, sure. So I'll forward that to you after the call.
All right. Thank you so much for being on the call today, Warren.
Sure.
Gave us some great information and some great food for thought for the future. Thanks so much, and thanks, everybody, for participating.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.